I was telling you there's a community rule that was in one of the caves, that one of the materials found in cave one. It's an incredible document. It's very exclusive, by the way. It believes in expulsion and banishment and cursing, all the stuff Paul believes in, but it's not anti-Semitic. It's just anti the opposite group, the way Paul is anti them. But it's very extreme and very, very beautiful in many ways. It has spiritualized temple imagery. It has all the imagery of the community council being a sacrifice, a holy essence, aroma unto God, spiritualized sacrifice imagery that you get in Paul. And then at the end it says, this is the time of the preparation of the way in the wilderness. What? What? This is the time of the preparation of the way in the wilderness? I think I've heard that before. God, where did I hear that before? Ha ha, the New Testament, John the Baptist. And then it says, at the end again, it repeats it, and repeats the whole phrase, make a straight way in the wilderness, and so on, and repeats it verbatim. This is column 8 and 9 of the community rule. And then it says, I forget how it puts it, but this is the time of the, I could pull it out, but I don't want to break the train and go shuffling full of book through a book for you. But basically it says, this is the time of the preparation of the way in the wilderness, and something to do with the zeal for the law, the zealots, the revolutionary groups, and the day of vengeance. So it's extremely apocalyptic, very vengeful, and very unremittingly militant. What do our Qumran scholars say? Oh, community rule, handwriting. We analyze the handwriting. That's 2nd century BC. 2nd century BC, on what basis? Oh, handwriting. But they don't have any exemplars of any handwriting at that time except the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's all manufactured at Harvard and the École Biblique. This handwriting supposed expertise. Internal data tells you, because other than that, in the community rule, is an organization just like the early church, is vocabulary just like the early church, except it's just the opposite of the early church. It's exclusive, and it is, you know, purity-minded, and so on and so forth. It's wilderness-oriented, but it's got Holy Spirit baptism in it, and it's got ritual immersion. I would place that document at the time of John the Baptist on the basis of internal evidence, and that's what I argue in all my work. That you have to go according to internal evidence, not according to authority. You have to read the documents. And you can't be deceived in what the deceivers are telling you. You have to go out there and do some work. Otherwise, you let them win. And once you let and once you do the work, you release a lot of other very good things. A lot of other, you release people's minds from a lot of negative authority. And that's what doing the work means, because if you want to go out there and really fight this fight, you've got to fight the people who are propagating the other side. And they're everywhere, as I told you. They're in a huge majority, and the literature backs them up. Only intelligence can win that fight. So this is, for me, what the study of the scrolls does. I've sort of encapsulated it in a nutshell. I want to answer one or two more questions on that point and then open it up to questions. Why did all this happen? Why did all this happen? Josephus, I think, tells us. He has a picture of John the Baptist that disagrees with the New Testament entirely. John the Baptist did not come to teach remission of sin in the wilderness. It wasn't remission of sin, as the New Testament puts it. For Josephus, John taught righteousness and piety. Righteousness was love your neighbor as yourself. Righteousness towards your fellow men. The two love commandments. Piety was loving God. Love God. Josephus presents all the Essenes as observing those two requirements. Righteousness towards your fellow man. Loving your fellow man. Loving your neighbor as yourself. The love commandment. Righteousness. And all the other prescriptions. Bathing. All those other kinds of things that go into being an Essene. Loving God. So Josephus said, he invited them to come to baptism, provided that the soul had already been cleansed beforehand by the practice of righteousness. That's a totally different idea than we had. And then he said, baptism was for bodily purification only, the norm of these immersion groups. So baptism was not for remission of sin. Remission of sin came when you had all of it. Your soul being purified by the practice of righteousness, and immersion, baptism, was only the last point. And that's John the Baptist, historical John the Baptist. But the New Testament has transmogrified that into Paulinism, because it knows you don't know this. And then finally, Josephus says, Herod wanted to put John to death because he was so popular among who? Gentiles? Foreigners? No, Jews. He was so, but the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Mark have John spitting on Jews. This is how you rewrite history. And you get a lot of disinformation, a lot of hatred in the process. And you are, to some extent, disinformed. So, Herod wanted to put John to death because he was so popular among the Jews that he feared they would do anything that he would suggest, including leading a revolution. This is in Josephus. What? I never heard that. That he was going to lead a revolution? And so he thought it better to take him to the fortress of Machaerus over here and have him beheaded, lest afterwards he regret having been too lenient with him. So Herod just put him to death because he thought he would lead a revolution because he was so popular among the Jews. And that's the authentic history. Aha, but what do we have? Ah, John, Herod is a lovely fellow. He doesn't want to kill John. He loves John. He even goes so far as to admit that John is a righteous man. Ah, the key doctrine in Palestine in this period, the tzaddik, the key doctrine of Kabbalah, the righteous one, the tzaddik. James is cognomen, what James was called by all groups. Herod knew John was a righteous man. But then what happened? It was birthday parties. Ah, the Romans love birthday parties. Great for Roman audiences. It was a birthday party, Herod's birthday party. And some lascivious girl came along and did a dance. And it turned Herod's head. He didn't really want to kill John. We don't want to impugn centurions. We don't want to impugn Roman officials. Josephus said in his introduction to the Jewish war, a lot of the histories suffer from two main problems: flattery of the Romans and vilification of the Jews. Aha. Then he goes on to do the same thing himself. Anyone who wanted to survive in this period did, and that's the flaw in the Gospels, and that's the flaw in this story. And that's what we're all subject to. So, what happens? This girl, who the New Testament doesn't even know her name, you have to go to Josephus to find out her name, that it's Salome, and now we know it's Salome that danced the seven veils. But in fact, Gospels, you think you got that from the Gospels, but it isn't there. The Gospels make another mistake that's corrected in Josephus. They have Salome's mother, Herodias, as you may remember, married to Philip. Aha, no. It's Salome who's married to Philip. All these things you can verify. I go through it in my book, in the histories of the period. But what's the point of it all? To rescue Roman officials, Roman-appointed puppets, Roman officers from any charge of guilt in what was going on in Palestine. Therefore, Pontius Pilate doesn't want to kill Jesus. His wife had a dream the night before where she learned that Jesus was a righteous man. But in other texts we learn that Pontius Pilate was the most bloodthirsty governor that was ever in Palestine and didn't scruple to shed human blood at any moment. But his wife had a dream and she said, shed not the blood of this righteous man. So Pontius Pilate went to the Jews and they said, his blood be on our heads. That's Christian theology to this moment. And he said, okay, you have said it, I wash my hands of it. I am the Roman official. I will not have the blood of this innocent man on my hands. And that's our picture to this present day. That is the rewrite. And that is what the Dead Sea Scrolls helped to overturn and reestablish what really went on there and what really went on against these Jewish messianic groups. Now, it doesn't necessarily concern you folks, but it concerns your ability to think. So, what was going on? Why was all this going on? The last thing that would influence that is Paul in Romans 13. He said, the ruling authorities, he had a Roman citizenship after all, and this governs everything that he said, the ruling authorities would put here on this earth by the power of God. God gave judgment on behalf of the ruling authorities. You have no right to overturn the judgment God gave. Therefore, you should not protest the ruling authorities. The wearing of the sword is its own reward. Righteousness has nothing to fear from magistrates. Tell that to the witnesses of the crucifixion of Jesus. Righteous conduct has nothing to fear from magistrates. And he gets to the final point. Therefore, you should pay your taxes to the ruling authorities, which is all the revolutionary groups were fighting against. That was the essence of all the revolutionary activity from 4 BC to 7 AD on up to the final war against Rome in 70 AD, where everything was lost by these revolutionary groups. I contend the scrolls are the literature of Messianic Judaism, revolutionary Judaism. Now, why do we want to overturn their results? Because it was such a problem to the Roman Empire in general. And anyone associated with this movement was being executed and obliterated, including John and all the others. Now, we know how John died. So what the documents are aimed at doing is deflecting criticism for the Roman execution of these leaders onto the local population itself, because they're the ones that would not let the Roman Empire live in peace and had recently revolted against Rome and made a very bloody war and were sending their messengers all over the Mediterranean. And that's what the scrolls bear out. Now, either suppose we agree the scrolls were Essenes. Well, then these are not the Essenes most people think of Essenes, because I've already showed you they are extremely militant, uncompromising, very extreme, apocalyptic, and what I have had the privilege of pointing out to everyone, including Bajan and Lee, who picked this up very strongly in their messianic legacy, very messianic. Therefore, I have called them, and they have gone along with that, the messianic movement in Palestine, the literature of the messianic movement in Palestine. Not Christianity. Book of Acts tells us Christianity was first called Christianity in Antioch around 45 AD overseas. What was it called in Palestine? Essenism, something else, Nazaritism, Scrollism, whatever. So, this is what the scrolls help to write and give us a true picture of what was going on in Palestine. And this is what the overseas authorities are anxious to conceal, because they want their movement to move in the Western world and not to be suppressed. And all those opposing the power of Rome ended up like the Dead Sea Scroll community. I think I'll end there, and I'll take your questions on any point that I hit on, because there's so much more to be talked about. You want to change your tape then now, or? Huh? You're okay? Okay, I should point out before we take the questions that there are, what happened in the scroll dispute is that everyone thought in 1954 that there was only one cave of documents found, Cave 1, and those were all published. But after the war, the Arab-Israeli war in 47-48, partition was agreed on, and the Dead Sea Scroll caves fell within the Palestinian side. Then the Jordanians took over the Palestinian side, and they controlled the whole area. At that time, 10 more caves were found from 1949 to 1954. The biggest one was what we call Cave 4, which is on one of the limestone cliffs above the settlement, which we call Qumran. That is where all these fragments came from. That was cleared out by the Bedouin. You say, why didn't the archaeologists do it? We don't know. These people from the École Biblique, led by Father DeVoe, went down to the caves and did a survey. They used Bedouins to do it while they sat down on tables eating their dinner and had the Bedouins up in the caves doing all the work for them. And K4 is something you could see from where they were sitting. And yet they didn't find K4. And not a couple of months later, the Bedouins went into K4 and cleaned it all out. And these are all the fragments we have from K4. And that is the biggest manuscript-bearing cave. So in that cave, we literally have some 600 different documents that have never been seen before, fragments of them, but 600 different documents. We only have them in bits and pieces. But because we have the documents from Cave 1, we basically can get a good picture. When was the shroud pulled down over the scroll problem? Around this period when Cave 4 was discovered, another cave, Cave 3, was discovered by the team that had a copper scroll lying on the surface of the ground. This we call copper because it was rolled. It was a bronze or copper tablet rolled, and it had to be taken to Manchester to be cut open. And that scroll, that copper scroll that had to be cut open, turned out to be a temple treasure list, a list of the hiding places of temple treasure, where it was buried and where it was secreted. Now, the official scroll team was horrified by this, because when it said, what are the Essenes, the poor, doing with the temple treasure list? They said, well, this had to be an imaginary thing, or dropped by a passerby, or some such explanation. But they couldn't have it published at that time. So they worked 10 years on it to make it seem like an imaginary list, when, of course, nobody would take the trouble of punching something into copper that was imaginary. The reason you punch it into copper is you didn't want it to disappear in a fire or something like that. So it was so precious that it was put on copper, and it was written hurriedly in flight. In any case, it's clearly the hiding place of the temple treasure. Who would have the hiding places of the temple treasure? These zealot revolutionaries in Palestine, which coordinates, therefore, the Essenes with the zealot revolutionaries in Palestine that were involved in the war against Rome and so on. It's all complicated, but Bajan and Lee go through it very quickly. At that time, in the New Yorker magazine, Edmund Wilson, a communist fellow traveler, was writing in 1955 his famous series on the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the meantime, the Jordanian government, the partition of Palestine had occurred, and the Jordanian government had given this École Biblique, these Dominican fathers, total control of the editorial process of the scrolls. What did they want with Hebrew documents, that is, the remaining scrolls? Nothing. And therefore, who was Johnny on the spot to deal with it and take it out of their hands? The Dominican fathers. At that moment, and the people who worked on it told me that, a curtain of silence was pulled down over the scrolls for 35 years. And these people vetted everything that came in there, looked and checked and saw what was in everything that came in there. Father DeVoe and Father Millick. They kept all the most important new documents, sectarian documents, to themselves. They edited them very slowly. And that's the significance of this book here. So what happened was the Edmund Wilson article suggesting that the scrolls had something to do with early Christianity and the copper scroll totally spooked the Dominican Father editorial team. And they, as this person told me who worked on them, wanted to pull down the curtain of secrecy till the crazies would go away. We, you, all of us are presumably the crazies. And we did go away. And everyone forgot about the scrolls for 35 years. That was extremely successful until idiots like myself came along and started agitating because I had this crazy theory that the Habakkuk commentary, already published scroll, had material about the life and death of the righteous teacher, and the life and death of the righteous teacher and the community he led was very similar to James the Just, the brother of Jesus. And I put that theory in many of these books that I just showed you, and Bajan and Lee recapitulated this theory in their book. And it was that drove me to see the remaining documents, because I had the theory that control of the unpublished manuscripts meant control of the field. And the way that worked is, as I think I had hinted earlier at the beginning of my talk, that they could, by giving these scrolls to selected students at Harvard and other places, create instant scholarly superstars. Then there were very few positions in this field, and they would place those students in key positions around the country. That would become a yay-saying network of like-minded people who could pejoricize all the work of their opponents, and that's what they did. But their opponents never got published. They reviewed their opponents. Their opponents never reviewed them. They got all the best positions. They controlled all the journals. They controlled all the research and all the approach to the research. And nobody who had an opposing point of view was allowed to publish any of the texts. It was only given to a select few. So when I came along and I discovered all this, at the, as the introducer told you, I was an NEH fellow at the Albright Institute in Palestine, well, the center of the American School of Archaeological Research, where the scrolls originally came in. And I was there a whole year, and I couldn't do anything. There was nothing to do. I might as well stay at home. If I'd gone up to the Huntington Library, which is around 25 miles from my house, I could have learned more. Because I was working on the parallels between the community of James and the community at Qumran. And there was nothing I could do there. So I sat there and did nothing. I sat in my room with my family and just watched television the whole year. But while I was there, I made a lot of contacts and discovered all the things that I've just told you about. And it laid the foundation for allowing me to do what I needed to do. So sitting there watching television was probably the best thing I ever did. So yeah, I watched Jordan television. So sometimes Israeli television. And I had a lot of tapes, like Japanese cartoon tapes and that my kids loved and stuff like that. So I was quite entertained the whole year. But I made the contacts I needed to get all the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what happened was I went down to the Israel Department of Antiquities. And I said, look, I'm here on a research grant. I want to look at the scrolls. Oh, you can't look at the scrolls. We can't show them to you. The unpublished scrolls, that is. You've got to go to the École Biblique. They control the editing process. You've got to go over there and ask Father Benoit, who had succeeded Father DeVoe, who then was succeeded by this John Strugnell person I mentioned. You've got to go ask them. Go over to Father Benoit, a very nice man in a white costume and so on, perfect Dominican friar. Oh, I can't give you permission to see the scrolls. You've got to go over to the Department of Antiquities. They run us around and around and around and around and around. And finally, some chap in the Department of Antiquities took pity on me. He saw me sitting out there kind of crying in my whatever it is, cups. And he said, psst, 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 psst. You want to see the list of the scrolls? I said, what? What? Are you calling? Yeah. He said, I'll show you the list of the scrolls. All the fragments. I said, rim? He said, yeah. Let me see him. I said, wait. In comes this huge computer printout of all the unpublished scrolls, and it blew my mind. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I scribbled down, he said, I can't give it to you, but you can look at it just to make yourself happy. And I scribbled down everything that I could on a sheet of paper so that I knew what they were holding there, and I knew what they actually had. Ultimately, I got from other sources, not him, overseas sources, a hold of that list, because I knew what it was that I was looking for and what I wanted to get a hold of. I got a hold of that list, and I sent it to the Biblical Archaeological Review, which was edited by this fellow Herschel Shanks in Washington. And people, Herschel Shanks, who later tried to make a huge capital out of this whole thing and ruin this publication of ours, colleagues of mine, when I spoke to him, I said, this guy who's editor of the Biblical Archaeological Review only wanted to promote this for his magazine and for his own importance, which maybe all of us want to do, but in any case, it's what he wanted to do. When I saw what he did to our book, publishing all the scrolls, he put this publisher's foreword in. That was his own presentation of all the correspondence of his magazine and everything else that drew a huge lawsuit on us in the Israeli government. And I couldn't believe that he had put this in our book, and I said to my colleague, he urinated in our book. He marked it like a dog marking a fire hydrant. And this produced a lawsuit, which I'm still under in the Israeli Supreme Court, of literally thousands upon thousands of dollars of damages because of his forward to our beautifully pure plates that we were all blamed for because our name was on the book. Of course, the public totally misunderstands that, but Bajan and Lee do make that clear. So in any case, I saw what was there, ultimately got hold of all the pictures through sources elsewhere that I'm not able to this day to reveal because you say, oh, you're just being secretive. No, because they will be sued and prosecuted still in Israel by the authorities for what occurred. And my feeling was if you break the monopoly, you break the authoritative interpretation of the scrolls. That was the whole point of it. if you break the clique, if you let everything open, if you let 1,000 voices sing, then we can have opposition scholars and everyone else giving their point of view. So that resulted in this book here, The Dead Sea Scrolls Uncovered, that came out in Penguin Books in 1992. And I say in that book, the joy it felt as an opposition scholar to actually be able to publish a document first before the cartel, the network, the consensus, what we call the Qumran Mafia. And in the process of publishing those documents, 50 unseen documents first, we could slip in our own interpretation for the first time, an opposition interpretation shown to the public as authoritative. That's what breaking the monopoly meant to me. And what we do with you is to let you be the final judge. You read our works, you read their works, and you tell us who's telling you the truth. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate having you.
My question is, I think that there either are or appears to be waterways that have run through Qumran, the Essene community, and that they were attached to the Dead Sea. Did you find anything in your research or in the Dead Sea Scrolls that indicated usage of these waterways, and could they possibly have been connected to the treasury houses?
Oh yeah, I believe there were waterways there. In fact, I think that's where the mythology of the Sea of Galilee to some extent came from, Jesus walking around the Sea of Galilee and floating on the waters and things like that, because the Dead Sea, you can't sink, you see. How many have been on the Dead Sea? Have you tried to swim in it? Could you sink? You get a lot of salt in your eyes, though. You don't blink at the right time, or do blink, or whatever. So, yeah, I agree with you. And there, if you know, I had any slides, which I didn't show, I brought tonight, but we decided it'd be too difficult to show slides and say anything, too. Some other time, maybe we'll do that if you want. But there's a wharf on the Dead Sea about 4 miles below what's known as Enfeshka. Enfeshka is, here's Qumran, Enfeshka is really where the springs come out under the mountains, and it's perennially flowing water. It means fresh, I think it means fresh well or something. But this is where the Qumran agriculture was carried on, and then down a little further is a wharf. And that obviously went across here to Machaerus, where John was killed. So there's a wharf here, and it's clearly a wharf. It's about, it's very interesting because it's about 100 yards in now from the, or not 100 feet in now from the present waterline, which shows that though the Dead Sea has receded a lot, it hasn't receded that much. And you can see it's a wharf because it's got storage granaries and so on, and the boats came up to there. So you're dead right. Boats did go around back and forth across the Dead Sea, maybe down to En Gedi and so on. And there's a lot of interesting material relating to that waterway material, but it's not in the scrolls in any way. I don't see it in the scrolls mentioned.
Okay, thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
I got two questions that really, I guess, stem from Lawrence Gardner's work with Bloodline of the Holy Grail. First being, could you comment on the origin of James's authority, whether that be directly due to his relation to Jesus or if it's something that descends farther back than that? And secondly, Lawrence Gardner's accounts or references that he's using cite James as traveling to Europe and becoming referenced to as under the name of Joseph.
Well, Lawrence Gardner and I have to part company on a few things like that. And you're going to have to determine what you think. I'm not in a dictatorial position or vice versa, but I will tell you this. All the evidence shows James was killed in Jerusalem in 62 AD. Josephus and all the early church sources give extensive detailed descriptions on what happened. So there may be other relatives. In fact, I think you see in the third part of this book here, I show you this is the paperback, but actually the hardback is a little bit easier to handle and prettier. In this hardback here, the last third, which we have to cut out of the German edition because it's too long, the last third deals with Jesus' brothers as apostles. And Jamesian communities in the East. And the names of the chapters, I'll get to the point in a minute, is the apostleship of James, Cephas and John, James the first to see Jesus, Last Supper scenarios, Jesus' brothers as apostles, Simon Bar-Cleophas and Simon the Zealot, and then in Jamesian communities in the East, Judas the brother of James and the conversion of King Agbar, the conversion of Queen Helen and the Ethiopian queen's eunuch, Judas Thomas and Theuda the brother of the Just One. Now I venture to say almost not one of those topics any of you has ever even heard of. That's how little information is disseminated on this subject. Yet we can spin 300 pages on those subjects of all new data that's never revealed to you. So the last section here deals with Judas, Jesus' other brothers. Lawrence Gardner and his sources may be mistaken, I can't say. Jesus had brothers, Judas, for instance, whom I think is confused with Judas Iscariot, Iscariot being a play on Sicarios, assassin, which to my mind is also playing on Christian, because Iscariot, he's a Christian, but his name is Iscariot, it's Sicarios, which is what Josephus pejoricizes as the most extreme wing of the Zealot movement that committed suicide on Masada. And they didn't commit suicide because they were cowards. They committed suicide because they believed in resurrection of the dead and they didn't want to be polluted. But that's a whole other story that Bage and Lee covered and so on. But this Judas the Zealot, whoever he was, this second or third brother of Jesus, did have children. And that is a known thing. So in all our sources, James is considered to be a lifelong virgin. All the sources confirm that, whether it's true or not. Hey, I can dispute sources and I'm happy to do that. But I think the virginity of Mary's, I didn't cover a lot of this stuff, it's in the book. I think the virginity of Mary didn't come from the virginity of Mary. I think it came from the virginity of James. In James's case, lifelong sexual abstinence, for I hope I'm not keeping you by sending you at the microphone there, but this triggers a lot of ideas, what you're saying, which I didn't cover. Lifelong, and that's what I need to trigger stuff, lifelong abstinence was helped by bathing in cold water. And Josephus tells us that he had a teacher in the wilderness called Bannus who wore only vegetable clothes. But James wore only linen, vegetable clothing, because he stayed away from animal hair. I also think the picture of John the Baptist wearing camel's hair and so on, and skin is taken from Elijah 800 years before, but has nothing to do with the first century. All these groups wore linen, white linen. And then I think this Bannus character deciphers a lot about James, that he was in sexual continence, a lifelong virgin, as it were. Now, early Christianity has developed the idea of the perpetual virginity of Mary. But that came in the second century. That's not in the Gospels. And it's not anywhere else in the first century. But it's a second century a doctrine that's aimed at James. The reason is, it's first given to you in a document called the Proto-Evangelium of James. An apocryphal gospel given to you in authoritative church manner that claims to be put into James's mouth, he being the closest living relative of the Lord, that he was not the brother of Jesus, that he was only the half-brother, the milk brother, the step-brother. So this is James supposedly testifying that he's not the brother, but that's doctored. And then in the process, he testifies to the perpetual virginity of Mary, that Mary was a virgin before Christ was born and after he was born, which is, of course, patently absurd. But the point is that, you see, where in Mary it makes no sense at all, in James it makes all kinds of sense in the sexual continence idea. And I think the lifelong virginity of James moves over to the virginity of Mary in doctrine, in doctrinal terms. And the perpetual virginity of Mary is directed exactly against people like James, because it's trying to say that Mary couldn't have had any other children except Jesus, because she was a virgin before and after the birth of Jesus, and that rules out the birth of the other brothers. But we know in the Gospels don't show any embarrassment about saying that his mother and brothers came to him. And the Gospels enumerate the names of the other brothers, James, Jude, Joses, and Simon. But the thing is, the Gospels like to downplay them by giving you slogans like, a prophet is never accepted in his own house, among his own people, and by his own kin. We love those kind of statements. And yet they're directed against the family and the succession of the family. And in that passage where it speaks about his mother and his brothers coming to him, they were kept outside. Jesus has kept them outside because of all the throng of little people that thronged around him. And they couldn't get close to him because the throng of little people, us, the new mission Gentile converts, are close to Jesus, and his family is removed from Jesus. So where Leonard got those materials is probably from genealogies that he was conversant with. But how accurate those genealogies in terms of the total mythologization that's already developing in the second century is difficult for me to understand. That is, those genealogies may represent information of the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. I don't know how accurate they are. And they may have been confused on this issue. They may have known that Jesus had brothers and that, in fact, some of the brothers had children. One, we know, and Eusebius tells us, that the grandchildren of Judas, the brother of Jesus, were rounded up by Vespasian. That's all in Eusebius. So we know that one of the other brothers, not James, had children. But honestly, from my sources, and I can only tell you what my sources say, and I don't want to gainsay someone that you love, my sources don't carry that out. Now, you're the one who has to be the final arbiter of these facts. All I can tell you is there is a brother of Jesus who did have children, and that's Judas, we know, for a fact from the contemporary sources. James seems to have been a lifelong virgin, as Epiphanius, Eusebius, and others tell us. He seemed to be a daily bather. He'd bathe in cold water to avoid his sexual problem. And it all got hung on Mary. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's the best I can do with it.
Close enough. Thank you much.
No, I'll give you the other. There's another part to it you had?
No, I was just hoping you would elaborate a little more.
Well, I don't want to disappoint you. I hate to disappoint people. I only do the best I can. I don't want to mislead you either. That's the data I have.
You are safe.
Okay.
I am not disappointed.
Okay. People really can follow complex arguments, and that is the truth of it. And that's, I think, where a lot of you people are at. You want complex things. You want to go to bed at night chewing on something substantial. I and others are trying to do that for you. Yes.
Hi. Well, I want to thank you for your ability to think.
Wait. Go ahead. Start again.
I want to thank you for your ability to pursue those long thoughts. What you said about the war scroll, it sounded like where you place it in history is that it's something that has already occurred, and that it was the fight of the Essenes or those people against the Romans, and that they fought their wars. The short description you gave sounds like something a little more modern age, and I just want to know whether this is place it historically, or that's just...
Well, I'll tell you, it's a good question. You're going to have to read the documents yourself and decide for yourself. That's what getting your teeth into it means. I tell you, you read that war scroll, I find it a thrilling document. I'd love to stand up here and read it all to you myself, but, you know, I don't have time to do that, and I didn't bring my annotated copy that I can pick out the good stuff for you. And it reads colorfully when you can pick out the good stuff, but it reads almost like a Cromwellian battle march. I mean, they have all of what's on the banners, all of what are on the missiles, all of what are on the slings, the power of God, the might of God, the glory of God, God's attack against his holy enemies, and so on. It's like Cromwell's army marching to war with their battle flags. It's the most incredible document. It may be purely imaginary. I don't say that it already happened. What I've said is this, that let us agree these are Essenes. But you see, we don't normally think of the Essenes as being as militant as this, as Cromwell's army. This is the new dimension. What I think we have here is holy, holy Nazarite people, completely dedicated, if you like, as lifelong Nazarites to this holy existence, and that's why some sexual avoidance is there, because sexual activity brought, for their mind, maybe not for ours, pollution of the camps. I'm not in that boat. I don't think that. But they thought that. So, you know, that's why, for instance, the war scroll says, no young man, person, cripple, or half-wit, or someone with a running fount, someone who was spewing sperm on the ground or something, could join the camps, because that made the camp impure to have to go bathe again, according to the ancient dietary bathing prescriptions. That was their mindset. So what I'm saying is this is a prescription for extreme militant activity. And either, you know, these are Essenes or they're not. If these are Essenes, then we've got to go according to these documents on how to define Essenes. If we go according to these documents, then they are both extreme, holy, committed, dedicated people and are contemplating apocalyptic war against all evil on the earth. And your question is this coming soon? Is this symbolic? Or is
it
going to...
Has it happened yet, or is it to come?
I think that's what they thought the war against Rome was. And I think that's why people committed suicide on Masada. Masada is the fortress down from Qumran, and these are all new terms for some of you, but we speak about them so easily in the field because for us, they're all old hat. Masada is down here. And I just believe that this is the fortress where these last holdouts in 73, after the fall of the temple, the Sicarii, no less. I don't think they were Sicarii. In my view, in this book, I say that Sicarios in the Roman lexicon also meant circumciser, because circumcision then was known as bodily mutilation, and it was banned by the Lex Cornelia de Sicarios in Latin, the ban on bodily mutilation, Sicarios being the bodily mutilizer. And I think this is how the Romans saw, remember in the letter to the Galatians, if you know it, James's party is called what? The party of the circumcision. And Paul fumigates against that. It's all very complex. I develop it here. But my answer to your question, finally, is that this is what I think this group was. Call them Essenes, call them Zealots, call them Sicarii, call them Christians. I call them messiness, extreme purity-minded messiness. All these other terms float about them. But one thing in their own documents they are calling themselves in the Habakkuk commentary is Ebionim. Ebionim. And now you learned enough Hebrew to know that. I think I've got it right here. Probably put it down under here. There it is. The Ebionites. The first sect we started talking about that Eusebius said were so poverty-stricken because they had a poverty-stricken Christology. The Dead Sea Scrolls don't use any other familiar term to talk about themselves except Ebion. They literally cry out that they're Ebionite. I believe they are.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hi, is your first name Robert?
Yeah.
Thank you for coming and
well,
sharing your knowledge.
Thanks for coming too. I appreciate your patience because I hate to put people through travail.
My blood family is mostly traditional Christian, and my question to you is, how do you view the new Christianity considering what you've uncovered?
Which new Christianity now?
That's my question. You spoke of a new Christianity.
Oh, I think that with James, we get someone to put our teeth into with more satisfaction than we had this basic pablum we had previously. That, to my mind, was kind of sugar-coated, candy-coated children's games. This is the real stuff of Palestinian messianism. This is what we come to grips with, and I think it can be very inspiring. You say, how do I know James was the real successor, someone asked. All the documents tell us, the church documents, even Paul. Later on in the book of Acts, when it stops fooling around and gets into the wee material in Acts 21, Paul comes up to Jerusalem. He's hurrying up there at Pentecost. Pentecost in the Dead Sea Scrolls, according to the Damascus document, is the day of the reunion of the desert camps. It's the same. Paul's hurrying to Jerusalem for the reunion of the early Christian community in Jerusalem. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, Pentecost is the day of the reunion of all the wilderness camps. Under the Mibaker, in Dead Sea Scroll language, the bishop. James is the bishop of the early church. He comes up to Jerusalem. Who does he meet in Acts now? It stops fooling us. James. And he goes in. And it says everyone gave praise to him. And then the leadership, James and the other brothers, the elders, and all the church assembly say, but you see, Paul, we have heard that you're teaching everywhere, in every place, against the law, against this temple, and against this place. So we want you to go into the temple and show there's no truth to the rumors that we have heard about you. And this is word for word from Acts, that you regularly observe the law. This is James talking to Paul. And Paul defers, even though we know he's doing just that everywhere, according to the book of Acts in his own writing. And he says, yeah, okay. We want you to pay for Nazarite oaths of four people here under oath because you have a lot of money, because you've raised a lot of money overseas. This is the real stuff. You go in there and pay for these people and to show there's no truth to the rumors that we have heard. And Paul agrees. But there's every truth to the rumors that we've heard. Paul has an answer for this in Corinthians. He's a Greek to the Greek. a Jew to the Jew, a lawkeeper to the lawkeeper, a lawbreaker to the lawbreaker. He will do whatever he has to do, he says, these are his own words, to win. That's how I fight, he said. I believe in winning. All the athletes at the stadium are vying for a prize. Basically, I vie for a prize that will never end, and using the wrestling language, that's how I fight, not beating the air. So this guy is a tough competitor. He'll do anything he can to win, and that's what happens. He wins. And that's our ethic in the West. Win, baby, win. Win at all costs. But I like a few beautiful losers. And I think this can give people a lot of thought. Righteousness, perfect righteousness, pure foods, purity regime, absolute sincerity, straightness, no moving to the lighter way, no tempering doctrines, no games. That's what I mean. A modern Christian get their teeth into, plus they're not infected by Jew hatred.
Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed your talk. I just wanted to ask if you had a little more explanation of James's role as the leader of the community.
Wow, boy, that's a long one. I wrote a whole book about that.
Yeah, I know.
I'll just read you some chapters, and I'll try to pick up one or two points from it. In the early part of the book, we have some of the following chapters. James's succession and the election to fill Judas Iscariot's office. The election of James in early church tradition. James's Rechabitism and Nazaritism. James's vegetarianism, abstention from blood, consuming no wine. James's bathing and clothing habits, etc., etc., etc. There's an awful lot of information, totally uncold, totally unpresented to anybody. But all I can tell you is the pseudo-Clementines portray him as this totally righteous person who everyone was petrified of. They all were shaking with fear when he would walk in because he was so, not ferocious, but so overpowering. And that's why I say we can get a real good picture of James as leader and as the bishop of the early community, the bishop of Jerusalem, and the bishop of bishops of all the communities. In the 40s and 50s, there really were no other communities but Jerusalem. The others were just seed bedding in other places. The Bishop of Jerusalem was the Bishop of Bishops, James the leader of Christianity everywhere. And Paul acknowledges that. When James comes, when the messengers of James comes down, he says in Galatians, everyone stopped eating with Gentiles. Now, I know we want to eat with Gentiles, but the pure foods people wouldn't because they were polluted by idols, it was considered, and fornication and lots of other things. And then Paul at that point calls Peter a hypocrite. He says, Peter, I know you used to not do this all the time, but when those from James came down, you stopped keeping table fellowships and you followed them in this hypocrisy. And then Paul says, I'm going to go to the Gentiles, and you're not having more part of any of this. So it's quite clear that Peter defers to James even in Paul's letters, and the representatives of James command everything. And we may not agree with their point of view, but that's because we see it through a Pauline perspective. I believe that from their own times, they were being as righteous as they know how to be. And the picture of James's leadership is very widespread. Now, if you add to this, it's in the Nag Hammadi text, it's in the Gospel of Thomas, it's in the Apocalypses of James in the Nag Hammadi text, it's in Jerome. By the way, I forgot to tell you, Jerome is the one who finally decided that the brothers were cousins, not brothers. Do you know how he decided that? Ah. He found a little reference in the Gospel of John that Mary had a sister called Mary. What? Yeah, I kid you not, it's there. She's called Mary, the sister of the mother of the Lord. Only the mother of the Lord isn't called Mary, her sister's called Mary. Wow, that's a good one. And she's the wife of Clopas. She has a husband called Clopas, and her sons are James, Jude, Simon, and Joses. So then he said, ah, that is the mother of the other brothers, Mary, the sister of her sister Mary. I kid you not. And that is how we now get that Jesus' brothers are not brothers, they're cousins. And that's in the 4th century. It is total nonsense. It is preposterous, but it points up a problem. Wherever the brothers and family of Jesus come into play in the scripture, all of this dissimulation comes into effect. And as I told you before, I think, Sometimes I forget what I've already said, but I think I said this. Brothers become cousins. Yeah, I did tell you that. Fathers become uncles. Mothers turn into their own sisters. And in fact, I think Jesus is the brother called Joses. And the reason he's called a brother of Jesus and Joses, you know, in Greek and are basically the same word. It's basically the same, you see. And we don't know anything about we know all about Simon, we know all about Judas, we know all about James, we don't know anything about Joses. So basically I think Jesus turned into his own brother as this disinformation went on and all these people were marginalized and distanced from the Son of God. And the reason was that in the second century, the doctrine of the supernatural Christ gained momentum and Jesus became the only begotten Son of God. I can show you how this worked, for instance, when the dove comes down in the John the Baptist episode. But it's too complicated to tell you. I can only tell you that it was changed from the psalm, "This is my son, at this moment have I begotten him," how it appears in the apocryphal gospels, to "This is my only begotten son, in him I am well pleased," which is not in the psalms. And with that little shift, we get an actual son of God from an adoptionist son of God. And what the Son of God is in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but what is it there and everywhere else? It is becoming perfectly righteous. As you become perfectly righteous, you become like unto a Son of God, and baptism is the last stage because you purify your body. But I mean, this is a very complicated, and it's a great question. I just probably don't have the mentality, the fatigue, or the wherewithal to answer it at the moment, but I urge you to read further in this stuff and see what you come up with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else? There's one or two more, and then we'll let you guys go to sleep, and me too. Yeah.
Thank you for your studies. They're very enlightening, but they cause other questions.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
And maybe some not directly or obviously directly related to all of the deceptions that you're talking about. Why is it that the Middle East is the axle of misery that we all rotate around?
That's an historical question. You know, we're all the creatures of history. And, you know, this is where our literature evolved from. Unfortunately, maybe it would be better if we had Eskimo culture or the Bantu people of Africa or the Aboriginals of Australia. We'd be probably healthier. In fact, Native American culture is probably healthier than a lot of things we've heard about. But we are creatures of our civilization to a certain extent. And this literature started in around the 10th century BC and reached a crescendo in the time of the Scrolls and the New Testament. And unfortunately or fortunately, this is what we're heirs to. Now, if this has got some problems, then all I want to do, I'm not advocating, I just want to sort it out. I may, in fact, prefer Native American religion, dolphins, fishing, any kind of food or whatever, or enlightenment from looking at the sun on the surf. I may rather have that. This is our heritage, but I like the intellectual challenge, which I mean about getting your teeth into something, of sorting this out. This is what modern, educated, sophisticated people want to do. This is how you can go to bed at night and find something interesting to chew your brain on, to try to get your teeth into that. Doesn't mean you have to believe every drop of it. It's not necessary for spiritual sustenance, but there may be some, and I told you what I think is there. To my mind, the most spiritually sustaining point in this whole thing, aside from your primal Adam thing that I read at the beginning, which is important for many of you, for me, what's most important is the absolute righteousness. That there is no compromise, there's no bending, there is absolute and pure righteousness. Insofar as these texts recommend that, I'll go down the line for them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's an honor to address you. I've followed your works and
Oh, really? Great. I'm pleased with that. Glad you even knew they existed. That's kind of it.
Yeah, actually, I followed a long time. But my question would be, I really enjoy studying the origins of religions and such. And one of the reasons I do is to get a greater spiritual understanding in terms of our school. And one of the concepts that we deal with here a lot is the concept of being Christ. And that's one of the reasons I like to study your works. I'm very interested in terms of how you see, I mean, it's kind of the million-dollar question now with all the books about the historical Jesus. But
historical darkness.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm more interested in terms of your perspective, the transition of the concept of Messiah to Christ and how the ideal of Christ, which is so, you know, the church has obviously propagated an ideal that's inspired many to even to go away from the church with that ideal.
Yeah, well, this relates to your previous gentleman's question. This stuff became so authoritative by the first century and things in people's mind that we're all heirs to this sense of deferring to all of these materials. I don't know how our righteous Christ might do in the modern world. That is a Christ that was unbending, that didn't have Easter rabbits, the reindeer and Christmas trees and the whole paraphernalia that people seem to relate to and love, and didn't accommodate all things to all men. And I've had students in my classes say, oh, you know what Jesus Christ is? He's me. Whatever I think he is, that's what he was.
Yeah.
Well, okay, but what I'm getting at is that you may be exactly correct. The Jesus idea or notion was very attractive. But I'm not sure whether it's not because they portrayed it as the heir to all this previous history and the whole, that I may not be giving a good answer to this, but it's the best I can do. And the impressiveness of this has been awe-inspiring over the millennia since then. But we haven't given the other a real chance yet, and I think that the first has really, to my mind, the first went down the drain in the Auschwitz death camps. That's my honest feeling. That could never have happened in an environment of fairness and an environment that people had not been infected with all kinds of hatred. And there is and I think there was a direct pipeline from that into what happened. I don't want to go into it. You all know what it is I'm talking about. Some people ask me, what was it like? I visited those places. And honestly, it was like going into a temple of death. That's what it was like. To my mind, that is where Western civilization fell to pieces. Because those are all people that we're heirs to. Now, we can come out of that. We don't need that on our conscience, and we shouldn't have that on our conscience. And I don't want that Peter in Scripture on my conscience, because I know that wasn't the historical Peter. And I know the Jesus of Scripture is not the historical Jesus. And I know a lot of other things, too, about those portrayals. So I think we can give these other things a chance, and we can also work our way out of this collapse of Western civilization. You know, our age is not going to be remembered for much except what I just told you. No one 100, 200, 500 years are going to be able to believe what we did in our time, from the First World War into the Second World War. No one is going to be able to believe it if we're all here to live that long. It's going to be looked upon like horror show. And some of those TV things that we see these people strutting around and behaving the way they're behaving, where are the voices that were to prevent this? So we have a lot of problems, and I think we can start to get out of them by first sorting out the history and getting it correct. So what you're asking, what about the beauty of these concepts? What about the things that do mean something? And you're referring to some of the historical points of the Jesus seminar, for instance, in Northern California.
Well, actually, let me interrupt you. I'm more interested in what you see the early Jewish transformation of the concept of Messiah from the more ancient non-Messiah views to Messiah at the time they believed in it to the Greek Christos.
Yeah,
there's a great transition there.
You can do a better job on it than me, but I just want to say one comment. I'll try to answer your thing then finally. That is on this Jesus seminar thing. As I've tried to tell you over and over again, you can't take votes about these things. This is not like, how many believe this? How many majority votes? All you can do is like the money changer simile. You got to use your intellectual brain and penetrate the veil of secrecy and other things that have been cloaked, that this has been cloaked in. And we have the wherewithal with the scrolls, thank God, to do this somewhat. So this thing you're talking about, the development of the messianic idea, it's a dangerous idea, no doubt. It produced a lot of negativity, and I'm not terribly impressed by it. You know, it worries me a whole lot, and I agree with you there. I don't know how it moved from messianism to Christos, but the primal Adam idea, which I have said in my books is the basis of the Christos, what was being called Christos in Greek was, in my mind, in Syriac and elsewhere, primal Adam. Now, I can find this primal Adam idea in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, the primal Adam idea is this person who goes into bodies, puts on the cloak of these bodies in age to age, and moves from person to person, taking on and off the cloak of the body. That is how I began all these things with, and that directly relates to things you people are doing and hearing and experiencing. So I think that is basically a religiously, morally harmless and, in fact, perhaps helpful idea. I don't think that that has got all this negativity associated that we get in the, to my mind, falsification of Scripture in interest of Roman power.
Sure.
That is a totally different ball game. But we have to sort all these things out in order to get the ball rolling on the right track in the Western civilization sphere, fortunately or unfortunately, of which we are a part. As I said, we only live 30 or 40 mature years. And we have an obligation to try to sort those things out intellectually so the next generation is not burdened by what we failed to sort out. So that's what we have to do. And I don't know if the messianic idea will help us in this. He never did come, and he still isn't coming, and we might wait another 100,000 years for the return of the Messiah. I'm not sure that's going to help us, but the primal Adam ideology, the putting on the cloak of the body, that idea you might find very sustaining, and I think many of you do. So with that, I thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Book, that's all I can say, and thanks a lot. I really appreciate your warmth. It's quite gratifying. No one ever receives me as warmly as you, and that's very kind of you to express that. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You want to say anything?
Thanks. You want to say a word? Go ahead, please. Okay. Thanks.
He's a brilliant man. And his mind works so fast that he's afraid that if he doesn't keep his mouth going, he's going to forget what it was that he wanted to say. And one of the reasons that I wanted Robert to come here is because I think that his book, James, Brother of Jesus, is probably one of the finest and most exhaustive works on the liberation from Christian superstition and guilt that there is. And he was right, and he says, you know, you go and you read this for yourself, and you find the information for yourself that'll help liberate you. But at the same time, he also gives credit in his book for exactly what we're doing here and the importance of what we're doing here. Inadvertently, he does. So I'm really proud to have had a brilliant man come here that wasn't about to compromise what he knew is truth for the sake of money from a publishing company. Thank you very much.